All right, good morning. Welcome to the Contemporary Worship at 11 o'clock. Hey, you guys showed up today. Look around the room. This is awesome. You're never really sure when you change the time if people are just go, okay, I'm not showing up just because you changed the time. But actually, in both of our services today, we've had really awesome attendance. And this morning, we're just going to continue the series that we started when the Olympics kind of got started. We're calling it Go for the Gold. And if you have a Bible or a way to access your Bible today, we're going to be in one of the most familiar verses of the Bible. It's 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 6 through 8. By the way, if you don't know about our app, you can download the app, and the sermon notes are on the app. You can also, of course, use your phone or whatever device you have to get at the biblical text as well. But we're going to be in 2 Timothy 4, 6 through 8. You know, we've all been like, I'm sure all of us have been moved by the incredible stories that have been coming out of the Olympics. All the events that have been happening in Rio de Janeiro. But one of the ones that struck me more than any of the others was the story that started in Columbus, Ohio. It was of a little girl whose father had abandoned her as a child, whose mother abandoned her as a child. She was a drug addict. And this little girl was tossed from home to home. She was in foster care where basically nobody wanted her, nobody loved her. And I mean, you look at that and you just think, my goodness, what are the chances of a person like that ever making it in life? And the people who study that say, next to zero. But Yogi Berra once said, it ain't over till it's over. And if that was true ever before, it was true in the life of this young lady, Simone Biles. We can show you a picture of her. You've been watching her on television. She is a resident of Texas. She lives down there in Houston. And this week, she surpassed all the other gold medalists in her category, winning 4 gold medals in the women's event. She is the greatest female gymnast in the world. Now you think about where she was and where she is today. Her story took a dramatic turn when she was just a baby and nobody wanted her. Her grandparents decided to adopt her. Her biological grandparents raised her in a Christian home, giving her an incredible foundation, she talks about, and introducing her to the Olympic sport of gymnastics. What an amazing story, isn't it? It's just not over till it's over. You can't just look at somebody's life and go, okay, that person's life is over. Maybe you're here today walking in going, man, my future could really use a turn right now. Maybe you just need to hear today, it ain't over for you yet. The Apostle Paul, who wrote these words in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 6, you could write his biography and it could be called, it's not over till it's over. All of his life is like these moments where you're like, okay, you can write it, it's over now, but no, it's not over yet. And now, finally, at the end of his life, he writes these words in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 6, 7, and 8. You know these verses. You've been around church at all. You know these verses well. And even if you haven't been, you probably know these words. This is where Paul says, kind of at the end of his life, kind of thinking about it, reflecting on it, he says, "For I am already being poured out like a drink offering. The time of my departure is near." He's not talking about getting on an airplane. He's talking about dying. And as he looks back over his life, this is what he says in verse 7, "I have fought the good fight." Now, I don't know if you can highlight or you can note that, but that word fight is really an important word. And then he says this, "I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. And now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. Not only to me, but to all who long for his appearing." It's not over till it's over. As Paul tries to make this point, he's grabbing hold of imagery from the Olympics. The Olympics was a big deal in Greece. It was a big part of the ancient world. And he uses 3 Olympic images this morning that I want to just point out to you. The first one, image number 1, is that of fighting the fight. This is the image of a boxer in the ring. Boxing was an Olympic sport. Now, a lot of times I've read this in the Bible and I've thought to myself, and maybe you have too, that Paul is here talking about fighting. He's thinking about, like, you know, I don't know, like a soldier. You know, sometimes he talks about we're a soldier. In Ephesians, he says, put on the armor of the Lord. But this is not militaristic language here. Paul's not afraid to use that language, but this is athletic imagery. This is the athletic imagery that he's using here to describe you and me in the life that God's called us to. The Christian life is like a fight in a boxing ring in the Olympics. Now, Jesus will sometimes use this word in John chapter 18 when he's on trial for his life. The man who's holding him on trial is Pontius Pilate. And remember, Pilate, before he had Jesus crucified, he said to him, "Are you a king?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And then Jesus said this, John 18:36, "But my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would," what's the word? "Fight." Now that's a militaristic one. Hey, if my kingdom was on earth, I'd be raising up some disciples with swords and spears. I'd be raising up an army, but that's not what he was doing. He wasn't doing that. He says, "My kingdom is from another place." Now, this is the same word that also Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 9:25. It's on your outline. We can put it on the screen, where he says, "Everyone who competes in the games." Everyone who competes in the game. The word "fight" is in the original language, the word agon, agon, where we get our word agony. Now, we watch the Olympics on television. We're like, "Hey, this is so amazing. Look at those guys." But to tell you the truth, if you're really going to be an Olympian, it's really hard, right? Or else we'd all be doing it. I would be doing it, and I'm not. The word agony is a good description, isn't it, for an athlete competing at that level. It's an ordeal. It's a trial. It's a difficulty. So when Paul starts talking about what is the Christian life like, he says, you know what? It's like an Olympic athlete. I mean, this is not easy. This is hard stuff. This is fighting the fight. And he uses the term here for the Olympic Games itself. The Olympics in the first century were not called the Olympics. They happened at Olympia. They called it the agony. That's what they called it. And when Paul was looking for a word, go, "Hey, what's a Christian life like?" He's like, "It's the agony. It's tough. It's an ordeal. It's a competition. It's this working so hard." In fact, if I could paraphrase it, it would go something like this. Paul's saying here, "I have competed well in the athletic contest of my life. I've competed well." Now, we've all kind of learned a little bit about Olympics by watching it on television, but in the ancient world, Olympics were a little bit different. The way you picked an Olympian is that each Greek city, had a gymnasium. Now, I'm not talking about a basketball court, you know, where they played basketball. That was invented at the YMCA, you know, 1900 years later. I'm talking about a gymnasium of the ancient world where there were runners and there was also education, and it was all happening kind of at the same time. And whoever was good enough would be picked by their city, would represent their city, and go to the game. It was an incredible honor to do this. Now, as I look at this today, I kind of go, if I'm looking for a guy who's an Olympian, everything I know about Paul would tell me he's probably not a good choice. As far as I know, Paul never was good at discus. He wasn't good at boxing. He wasn't good at running. As far as I can tell, he was really good at shipwrecking. He was really good at getting whipped. He was really good at getting thrown in prison. So the analogy here is kind of like that old analogy. It's not the dog in the fight, it's the fight in the dog. And as Paul's using this analogy of himself, he's saying not that he's some great Olympian. He's saying, look, there's just a passion inside of me. There's just this fire inside of me. There's just this hunger inside of me that says no obstacle can't be overcome, that no race can't be run, that the fighting the good fight is what's happening on the inside of Paul. He's saying, I fought the good fight. We see this in sports. We see it in history. We see it in medical breakthroughs. You know, of another era, the great baseball hero, one of the greats was Lou Gehrig. And, you know, we sometimes talk about Lou Gehrig, and it's kind of like, well, I don't really know much about him. Well, here's one thing you need to know about Lou Gehrig. It's incredible. Lou Gehrig played 2,130 consecutive baseball games. 2,130 consecutive. You're saying, well, wasn't he ever, like, hurt? Yeah, in fact, he broke fingers 17 times. Now, I didn't say 17 fingers. He doesn't have that many fingers. Now, think about that. That's not possible, right? You only got 10. So, but he did break 17 fingers, and he played 2,130 consecutive games. It's incredible. How about, remember Michelangelo? We always talk about Michelangelo. He painted the Sistine Chapel. You know, when he got that assignment, he had to lay on his back for 2 years and paint that thing. But the problem with Michelangelo is he had a really bad back, and every day was in agony. There's a guy in medicine a lot of times we don't even think about. His name was Jonas Salk. Jonas Salk worked 16 hours a day, 6 days a week for 5 years to make this little thing called the vaccine. Created this thing called the polio vaccine. It absolutely transformed the world. A lot of us in this room don't even realize that our lives were saved by the incredible hard work of Jonas Salk. Today, polio was almost eradicated from the planet because of it. I'm looking at these examples, and these are just ordinary people, but the fight was inside of them. The fight was there. They knew the task required it. There's sometimes in history, sometimes in life, when we've got to bring the fight to it. As I look at our world today, those of us who call ourselves Christians, it's not easy being a Christian. I mean, the challenge in our world today is to kind of just say, you know what, I'm just going to stay out of this. I'm going to sit on the sidelines. I'm going to watch this one from the stands. But the call of the Christian is to fight the fight. It's to be down there on the field. The pastor, Kent Hughes, was also a cartoon writer. He's still alive. He did a cartoon one time, and it appeared in the New Yorker magazine. And he called it The Light Church, L-I-T-E. And what he did is he tried to describe what the modern American church looks like. This is his description. The Light Church, 24% fewer commitments. Home of the 7.5% tithe. 15-minute sermons. Nobody say amen on that one, okay? 45-minute worship services. We have only 8 commandments. Your choice. Which ones are you going to choose, right? We have just 3 spiritual laws. Everything you've ever wanted in a church and less. You know, that's an accurate description, isn't it, of many of the Christians in our world today? They want the light gospel. They want the light Jesus. They want the light whatever. But these times are calling on us as believers to be people who are ready to fight the fight. God is looking for some people who are some Olympians for him. And that's the first image. And then he switches metaphors on us from a boxer in the ring to a runner in the race. And he talks about finishing the race. He talks here about finishing the race. That's the second image. And you know, Paul's always talking about running, but here he's talking about finishing. I've been in a lot of races, but there's a difference between running and finishing, right? He's talking about finishing this race. And in Philippians, he said something like this. He said, then, Philippians 2:16, and then I will be able to boast on the day of Christ that I did not run or labor in vain. He's thinking about the end of the race. He's thinking about what's going to happen afterwards. The word here for race is not the word agon. You know, we're talking about the agony, the struggle. It's literally the word the course. In Greek, it's the word trek. Star trek. Anybody remember that? That word trek or track is where that comes from. That literally the course is not just like, hey, I'm going to go out and run somewhere. It's the track. It's the actual event that must be accomplished, that must be completed. It's the same word that we looked at last week when we looked at Hebrews 12, when it says this. Therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the trek, the race marked out for us. Let's finish the race. This was always Paul's goal. This was always Paul's goal. Paul never said, hey, I want to just start following Jesus, and I don't really care what happens after that. He always had the goal that he was going to run this race for Jesus all of his life. In fact, one of the most emotional moments in the whole Bible happens in the book of Acts. And it's at that moment when Paul's already finished missionary trip 1, missionary trip 2, missionary trip 3, and he is getting ready to go to Jerusalem. And he stops off on the little bay town of Miletus, off the modern country of Turkey, off the coast of the modern country of Turkey. And he comes to Miletus and he sends couriers that bring back some of the church from Ephesus, and they say, Paul, don't go to Jerusalem. We've been praying, and God's just made it real clear to us. You go to Jerusalem, you're not coming back. They're going to arrest you, and you're going to die. And if you know history, you know that Paul, when he goes to Jerusalem, gets arrested, taken to trial at Rome, where eventually he will die. But in that single moment, in that moment when they said, Paul, don't go, you're going to die. This is what Paul said, and it reveals the heart of this man. Acts chapter 20, verse 24. He says, however, I consider my life worth nothing to me. My only aim is to finish the race. My only goal, my only purpose is to finish the race and complete the task that the Lord Jesus has given me, the task of testifying to the good news of God's grace. There have been so many incredible stories that have come out of the Olympics this year, and certainly one of the big ones is Michael Phelps' story, right? Michael Phelps is such an incredible Olympic athlete with so many gold medals. But actually, just in the last few weeks, another news story came out. He sat down with ESPN, and he revealed that after he won last time around in 2012, he kind of went into a dark period of his life. He told ESPN that in 2012, he retired, and he began to, quote, struggle to figure out who he was outside of the pool. Quote, I was a train wreck. I was like a time bomb waiting to go off. I had no self-esteem, no self-worth. I'm like, Michael Phelps, the greatest Olympian ever, said I have no self-esteem and no self-worth. He said there were times where I didn't want to be here. It was not good. I felt lost. He started self-medicating, and the whole world learned about it when he was arrested for DWI, driving while intoxicated. After that event, he cut himself completely off from his family, all of his loved ones. He said that he thought the world would just be better off without me. I figured that that was the best thing to do, just end my life. Michael Phelps? He says that's when a friend came to his rescue, an all-pro linebacker named Ray Lewis. Phelps always thought of him as kind of his older brother. Seeing his hopelessness and despair in his young friend Lewis, an outspoken Christian told him, quote, this is when we fight. Think about that. This is when we fight. This is when real character shows up. Lewis looks at Michael Phelps and says, don't shut down. If you shut down, we all lose. Lewis convinced Phelps to go into drug rehab or into a rehab place and gave him a book. Some of you heard about this. He gave him a Baptist pastor's book called The Purpose-Driven Life. Phelps read it. He said it changed his life. Within a few days, Phelps called up Lewis. He said, man, this book is crazy. The thing that's going on, oh my gosh, my brain, I can't thank you enough, man. You saved my life. Phelps told ESPN that Rick Warren's book, quote, turned me into believing there is a power greater than myself, that there is a purpose for me on this planet. Man, if Michael Phelps can't find purpose in this life but can only find it in God, do any of us have an opportunity to? I mean, if there's not only purpose found in God, then Michael Phelps would have certainly found it. The Apostle Paul says, look, this is my only aim. This is my only goal. I want to finish this race for him. He's the one that gives me purpose, that gives life its meaning and its goal. Paul uses one last image. Image number three is what happens after the race, the receiving of the crown. I thought I might just describe to you the fact that in modern Olympics, there's a gold medal, a silver medal, a bronze medal, but in the ancient Olympics, there was only one award given for the winner, just one. And an award ceremony looked a little bit different. Nobody was draped in their national flag, for one thing. A herald would announce the name of the winner, a judge called a Hellenodikos, say that three times fast, which just means a Greek judge, placed a palm leaf in their hands. Spectators applauded and threw flowers. They tied a ribbon of red wool around his head and hands in the sign of victory. After this, they went to the temple. Because you've got to remember, in the Olympics, it was always religious. It was always religious. And they would go to the temple of the highest god of the Greeks called Zeus. And in a loud voice, the herald would announce the name of the Olympic victor, his father, and his city. Now think about that and think about what Paul's saying as he's looking for that day. That day when not in the Olympic race, but in the race of the Christian life, he's going to stand before the judge and be given the prize. The crown that he uses here, the description, is not a diadem. You know those big old crowns of gold for a king. But it's a victor's wreath. It's not like the medieval crowns with gold and, you know, and diamond encrusted and all that. It's just a laurel leaf wrapping around your head. I mean, I don't know about you, but if they just went outside and cut a few limbs off a plant, or a tree and wrapped around my head. It just doesn't have the same effect as a gold medal. But they weren't doing it for that. They were doing it for the honor, for the glory, to be named the only one. The crown was also given at the end of another event, given to the winner of the marathon. Some of you in this room have probably run marathons, and so you may or may know that a marathon gets its name from the time when the war was won and they wanted to tell the people of Athens. And so a runner ran from the city of Marathon 26 miles to the city of Athens. And that's why the marathon is a race of 26 miles. And at the end, they would receive the crown, not the gold crown of the diadem of a king, but a victor's wreath. And this was awarded, it's the last thing, by the judge. The Hellenodokai were the judges. There were 10 of them. They, at the end of a race, they sat like in a juror's box. But one of them was the leader of the group and would place the honor upon the person who won. The Apostle Paul is imagining that one standing out amongst the others is Jesus. That at the end of the race, the end of life, at the end of it all for you and me, that we would stand before the judge and he would judge us. Paul said that in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10, a verse that when I first read it has haunted me my whole life. It's chased me down many a time. And this is what Paul says. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. Each of us may receive what is due for the things done in the body, whether good or bad. It's kind of a frightening thought, isn't it? That one of these days we're going to have to stand before the judgment of God. And he's going to look at our life. He's going to look at how we fought the fight, how we ran the race, how we carried on the Christian life. We know Paul's thinking about his death here because he says he's like an offering being poured out, a drink offering poured out. Well, what they would do is they'd go into the temple and there'd be like a fire burning for the sacrifice, and they'd take a goblet of wine and they'd pour it on the fire, and it would just go up in a poof of smoke. The Bible tells us that our life is like a poof of smoke. The Bible says that our life is like a vapor. We're here today, we're gone tomorrow. But the Bible also says, don't think that when it's over, it's over. The book of Hebrews says that it is appointed unto every man once to die, and then comes the judgment. In other words, it's not over, even when it's over. That at the end of the race of this life, each of us will stand before the judgment seat of him who judges all of our hearts and all of our minds and all of our lives.